number of Americans suffering from hunger and very low food security grew by 800,000 people in 2011 to a total of 17 million, according to a USDA report released last week. Food insecurity is defined as a person's inability to consistently feed him or herself on a daily basis. The numbers are a grim component to a recent government admission that a record 46.7 million Americans are now enrolled for food stamps. That's one of the nation's largest anti-hunger programs. Recent warnings by three United Nations agencies point to a spike in global food prices in what could be a repeat of the 2008 food crisis. The Food and Agriculture Organization points to a significant increase in food prices in July, linked to a rise in commodity prices of corn, wheat, and soybeans as a result of a severe U.S. drought. A new report by the human rights group Oxfam points out that climate change will lead to greater instability in food production and hence prices. The report also predicts that by 2030, the average price of staple crops like maize, wheat and rice will double. These increases, they say, will punish the world's poor, who in some countries spend up to 80% of their income on food. Experts say the problem of food affordability will likely be compounded by the rising affluence of China, where the demand for environmentally costly meat and dairy products is expected to grow with its burgeoning middle class. Discussion of the food crisis often raises the issue of population growth, implying that there is not enough capacity to produce food for the planet. But in reality, according to my guest Raj Patel, we are producing more calories per person today than ever before, and that it is a matter of food distribution rather than food production. Raj Patel is a food justice activist, a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies, a fellow at Food First, and author of the acclaimed book Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. Welcome to Uprising, Raj Patel.
Thanks very much, Anani.
Well, let's start global and then go local. The UN put out a report that was quite worrisome recently, although as of last week, it did report that world food prices have stabilized, but only close to those prices in 2008 when there was also a major crisis. How do you explain this crisis in food and the costs of food? And to someone like yourself who's really studied our food system, does it even come as a surprise?
It doesn't come as a surprise. I think that's the easy answer. The hard answer is why these prices are going up. We've got a number of factors that are responsible. Climate change is clearly an issue here, although it is taboo in the United States in conventional circles to talk about climate change. Pretty much the rest of the world seems to agree that the kinds of strange weather events that result in extreme drought or rains coming at the wrong time of year or pests moving up mountains to infect crops that once used to be clear of them. There is a range of climatic reasons why harvests are down and unpredictable. But beyond that, I mean, bear in mind, throughout human history, we've been used to droughts and famines and strange climatic events. And the way that humans in the past have dealt with the unpredictability of nature is to have contingency plans, like grain reserves, for example. But over the past decades, driven by neoliberal economic policy, those grain reserves have been frittered away. They've been sold and privatized because it has been argued that it is inefficient for government to be spending scarce resources on stockpiling grain when, if governments needed to buy grain, that all they had to do was turn to the international market. Well, the trouble with that is that having gotten rid of public grain reserves and having sort of tempered down the stocks in public hands, what happens when there is a food price crisis is that countries that are dependent on importing food find themselves facing a very steep import bill. And that, again, is a policy reason for why these food prices are high, is because we have this globalized, integrated market, it means that there's an entire world competing for the output of just a few powerful countries. And that's a sort of an overview of why it is that we're in these strange times. I mean, yes, climate matters. Yes, we have some ridiculous policies like biofuels, for example, and the mandates in Europe and the United States that demand that we grow corn or other kinds of crops in order to turn them into fuel rather than into food. But there's also these real sort of deep economic issues around economic ideology that are preventing us from having the kinds of buffers in place for these food price shocks that we need in order to make sure that people are not going hungry. And the proof of the failure of our policies right now is that there are a billion people who are malnourished, more or less, around the world. And that's at a time where we're not at sort of all-time record harvest, but we are producing more calories per person than we ever have before in human history. And the fact that there are a billion people going hungry at the same time as we have more calories per person than ever before is testament to how broken our food system is.
Now, what role does speculation in commodity markets play?
This is a really vexed question. If you ask economists, they will say, well, you know, speculation is really just about people creating liquidity in a market for insurance. And so every time someone makes $1 million and is on the front page of the Financial Times, someone else has lost their shirt. And so really, although it looks like speculators are making a lot of money, they're making a lot of money off the backs of other speculators who are losing a lot of money. And therefore, we don't have to worry about any of this. Unfortunately, while economists are happy with that kind of explanation, if you look at the performance of banks and of commodity funds that are in the agricultural commodities market and in the market for food, they're having a great time. They don't seem to be, no one seems to be losing money in their world, because when there is a shortage of food and when prices are uncertain and unpredictable, there's always an opportunity for people to be able to engage in what's called arbitrage of moving food from one part of the world to another and charging people for it. And so the head of Glencore is one of these large agricultural trading firms, was quoted recently as saying that this food price crisis is an abundance of opportunity. And similarly, Barclays Bank has made, according to The Independent, about £500 million off trading in food and agricultural commodities products recently. And that's a sign that while there's plenty of debate in the economics community about the extent of speculation in driving up food prices, there does seem to be an abundance of practical evidence that people are making a great deal of money out of this crisis.
Raj Patel, I want to stay on climate change for a little longer. You mentioned it earlier, but there was a new report by Oxfam about how the changing climate, which we're already witnessing so clearly this year, is leading to a spike in food prices. But even when you have extreme weather conditions where droughts and floods can ruin crops, because we have this globalized food system, doesn't all of the food essentially funnel through this globalized food system?
Well, it does, but that's why a shock in Kazakhstan or a shock in the United States can propagate around the world. So, for example, I mean, let's think about the corn price. Because the United States is the world's largest exporter of corn, what happened in the Midwest and what's continuing there with the drought means that the global market for corn gets affected by what happens in the Midwest of the United States. And that points precisely to this sort of architecture of international markets that's really just a century or so old, maybe a little bit more when it comes to globalized markets in wheat. But in corn, it's really that this is a very modern problem, and one that we know the way out of. We have many examples of public policies where by providing grain stores, by providing public stocks, by providing resources invested in alternative mechanisms for growing food, by not requiring that corn be turned into ethanol, by moving away from the kind of policies that turn our corn into high fructose corn syrup. These kinds of ideas are ones that we know that are fairly straightforward, that we know to be able to insulate the world from the vagaries of climate in one particular part of the world. But the reason that climate change matters so much at the moment and why its effects are magnified is because we have a net that stretches us tight, close to each other, in ways that in the past, if there was a sort of a strange climatic event in one part of the world, it wouldn't matter so much for other parts of the world. But now it does.
Let's go to the United States. On Wednesday of last week, the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, released a troubling report showing that over the past year, in 2011, nearly 15% of households in the richest country in the world were food insecure. How is this even possible?
Well, I mean, I think that this points to the deeper issue again here, that although, you know, you may find in the newspapers certain concerns about food prices and is there a crisis, actually there's been a crisis for a very long time. I mean, globally, before, you know, the 2008, we still had 800 million people who were hungry, and now we have a billion. In the United States, things were actually a little better. I mean, before the food price crisis in 2008, the number of food insecure Americans was still appalling, but it was merely 35 million people. But since the food crisis in 2008, those numbers have been absolutely higher. And that's the fact that we're now at 15% of the population, or to put it differently, that there are now over 50 million Americans who are food insecure. That's, in a sense, again, not surprising, because what's going on? You have higher food prices in the United States, but what you really have, and the reason people go hungry, is not because the U.S. has a shortage of food. I mean, go to your local supermarket, wherever it is, you will find it hard to make the case that the U.S. is suffering from a food shortage. You walk down the aisles, and there's plenty of everything. But the reason people go hungry in the United States and around the world is not because our world is not producing enough food. We produce more than enough food to feed everyone 1.5 times over. The reason people go hungry today is because of poverty, because they are too poor to afford the food that is in front of them.
And shouldn't it be mentioned that in the U.S., much of our food is quite subsidized? We actually don't have as much of our income going towards food overall, I understand, than other countries do.
That's absolutely right, Sonali. I mean, as a proportion of our income, we in the U.S. pay less on food than any other country in the OECD. Any other rich country on earth, for a couple of reasons. I mean, there are cultural reasons why other countries in the world like to spend more of their money on food. Food here has a lesser sort of social standing than in other parts of the world. But also, there's another reason, which is that in exchange for creepingly small increases in real wages, in exchange for cheap gas and cheap food, the U.S. working class has lower wages, has had lower wage increases than other parts of the world. There's been a sort of Faustian bargain in the U.S. that cheap food and cheap gas has been the excuse for low wages.
Now, climate change is only going to get worse and worse, because it doesn't look like we are at all getting on a path towards curbing greenhouse gases enough. And even here in the U.S., droughts and hurricanes have really affected crops, as has happened the world over. What do you foresee happening? In 2008, the food crisis sparked riots around the world. People died. Is there a fear that that could happen this year?
Well, I certainly think policymakers fear the consequences of food rebellions. And these rebellions, often in the media they were called riots, with the idea that the people sort of madly took to the streets and merely smashed windows and demanded food. But actually, in all of these cases, food was a sort of proximate cause for people demanding political change. People forget that the Arab Spring started with a protest over the high price of wheat in 2011. And people forget that the last thing that President Ben Ali did before he fled Tunisia was to drop the price of bread. So food is absolutely a sort of fuel to political change, and when people are ready for to take to the streets because they have no choice, then demands for food have historically and continue to be very real issues for a very large number of people on Earth. So I do see that as a dynamic, but it needn't be a bad one. I mean, I think people democratically taking to the streets to demand change is a good thing. What troubles me is that we still have a crisis where there are a billion people going hungry, and the way our media, or the way the mainstream media treats this, is as business as usual, and it's not. It's absolutely a serious and ongoing crisis. And perhaps the silver lining to this is that despite being ignored by the mainstream media. There are thousands of solutions being experimented and people coming up with new ways of farming and of distributing food that that ignore the state or find new ways of making the governments do the bidding of the people. And I think that that's a silver lining on a very dark cloud.
And briefly, Raj, where are some good resources people can turn to for those innovative solutions that can pave the way for a future where food insecurity is a thing of the past?
Well, there are a range of places to go. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Rights to Food has many of these resources at a policy level. And if you go to srfood.org, you can find them there. Food First, of course, has for over 40 years now presented some of these solutions in really exciting ways. And if you go to foodfirst.org, you'll find some of those resources there.
Wonderful. srfood.org and foodfirst.org are the websites. We'll link those to our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. Raj Patel, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Sonali. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Raj Patel, food justice activist and a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies. He's also a fellow at Food First and author of the acclaimed book Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. If you want to listen to my hour-long interview with Raj about his book that I did a couple of years ago, check out uprisingradio.org and type in Raj Patel in the search function, and you can listen to the entire in-studio interview with him.